June 18th, 1977, Tucson, Arizona. 39-year-old Chuck Morgan's body is found lying near his new car, 40 miles west of his house, 11 days after he disappeared. An escrow agent who owned his own business, police rule it a suicide, but many believe his death was a cold-blooded murder due to his involvement with the mafia. A mystery to this day, two more deaths have been associated with people investigating or thought to be investigating Chuck's murder. This is the story of Chuck Morgan, mystery, murder, and maybe the mob. Hey y'all, I'm Chris Calvert.
And I'm her husband, Rob Potter. Welcome to Hitch to Homicide.
For better or worse.
Till death do us part.
Welcome back, everybody.
Yes, welcome, welcome, welcome. And for our friends in the Indian state of Mizoram.
Okay.
Chibai, chibai, chibai.
I like it.
Yeah.
Well, if you can't tell.
Yes.
Rob was sick last week, and guess who gave me his cold?
The gift that keeps on giving.
I've lost my voice.
Yeah, but she's been a trooper. She's pushing through.
I'm pushing through.
Yep.
So just pretend that I have a very sultry voice today, a very sultry true crime voice today.
Yeah, baby. We can both talk like that now.
Okay, okay. That's probably how I got the cold.
Here we go.
Wherever you're listening, be sure to like, rate, and review the podcast. You can subscribe to Hitch to Homicide on just about any podcast platform.
Yep.
We appreciate all your emails and your comments and your likes. And speaking of comments and appreciation,
yeah,
we truly love and appreciate our true crime family.
Yes, we do.
The in-laws and outlaws.
Yep.
Go to Facebook and you can join.
Yes.
Lots of fun people in there.
Yep.
Today's case is so crazy. Rob's really going to like this one.
Okay.
Because he's been watching mob documentaries lately.
Yeah, there's something just very interesting about the mob and the mafia that I have to watch every documentary, every film. Goodfellas is one of my favorite movies. Yeah.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit about them today.
All right.
Before we get started, let me thank some sources. Cold Case Explorations, Reddit, Sword and Scale, Unsolved Mysteries, The Arizona Daily Star, The Tucson Citizen, and DonDevereaux.com.
All right. Well, you ready?
I am.
Let's do it.
Charles Curtis Morgan, Chuck, he goes by Chuck,
okay,
is born on March 16th, 1938 in Everett, Washington State.
All right.
His parents are Leonard and Doris Curtis Morgan. Chuck will have a younger brother, Michael. Now, there's not a lot out there about Chuck's younger life and him growing up. We do know that he graduates from the University of Arizona, where he is on the rifle team.
Oh, wow.
He married Ruth Eileen Ostro in 1958, and these two would have four daughters.
Okay.
And I don't know when, but I think at some point around 1962, Chuck and Ruth settle for good in Tucson, Arizona, and Chuck begins working in escrow.
Hmm.
He worked at Western Title, but he's going to be fired in January of 1977 after he has a personality clash with his supervisor.
Yeah.
This is when he opens his own escrow company, Statewide Escrow Service, Inc.
Okay.
He's a 39-year-old guy, and just to clarify, escrow companies act as a neutral third party to collect required funds and documents involved in the closing process of buying property or a home, including the initial earnest money, the loan documents, and the signed deed.
Sort of like when you sell something on eBay.
Can you tell I looked that up just so I could get it exactly right?
It was good.
But something I didn't realize is that in the 1970s, Arizona had these really lax state laws that made it super easy to buy land through an anonymous trust account.
Hmm.
So it's a perfect place to funnel drugs and launder money. And when word gets around that it's easy to clean your money in Arizona,
guess who's showing up?
It's suddenly a haven for crime syndicates.
Yep.
And by 1977, over 500 racketeers called Arizona home.
Wow.
And something they all needed, someone they all needed, was an escrow agent right. to make all this happen.
Sure.
They needed somebody to make the dirty money all legal through their anonymous trust.
Okay.
A facilitator. And Chuck Morgan was one of these facilitators.
Right.
After the fact, Chuck tells his wife, Ruth, that he's done business with known members of organized crime syndicates, of mafia families.
Wow.
So let's talk about a couple of them. One was led by former New York Don Joseph Bonanno, mm-hmm. better known as Joey Bananas.
Bananas.
I can't believe you knew that.
I know all these guys.
Joey Bananas.
Yep.
He's the head of a Sicilian crime family. This guy, I mean, what a story. He immigrates to the United States at the age of 3 in 1908. He goes back to Italy with his family 10 years later in 1918. Then he slips back into the United States by stowing away on a Cuban fishing boat and reorganized as the Bonanno crime family, becoming a boss at the age of 26.
Yeah, he was very young. Him and Al Capone were probably the two youngest mob bosses.
Yeah. Two really young guys, yeah.
Yep.
But he had a rather lengthy and bloody career, Joey Bananas.
Yep.
And he and his son moved to Arizona, Tucson, where Chuck lived in 1974.
Okay.
Another client, the Ned Warren family. Ned Warren Sr. was a convicted swindler known as the godfather of land fraud.
Mm.
He arrived in Arizona in 1961, reportedly sent there by New York underworld members, just to develop a land fraud operation.
Really?
He operated dozens of land sales companies, and they lied about everything. They misrepresented everything to the investors. They said that it was habitable and that there were paved roads and access to utilities. None of this was true. They would also sell the same parcel of land to different people and sell the same mortgages to these parcels to multiple lenders.
Wow.
Yeah. So mafia in real estate. That's it right there.
Yep. Yep.
Now, because there's so many mafia guys in Arizona, all this influence leads to all these gangland style killings in Arizona.
Yeah.
One of the more famous being the murder of investigative reporter Don Bowles on June 2nd, 1976, when six stacks of dynamite were taped to the underside of his car. On the driver's side, under the driver's seat.
Let me guess, he didn't survive that.
Ned Warren's gang was thought responsible for his death because he was getting too close to exposing them. And actually, you say he didn't survive it. He, like, tried to get out of the car. He didn't have arms or legs, nothing. And he was able to talk to authorities before he died. I think he lived for, like, 6 days.
Wow.
So these are the kind of families that they believe Chuck was helping. He's helping them transfer funds from cash into gold and platinum bullion.
Wow.
He would never go into specifics with Ruth because he thought the less you know, honey, the better off you're going to be.
Sure.
Chuck was also allegedly, and I say this allegedly because the United States government has never confirmed this, that he was working as a Treasury agent.
Mm.
It was thought that Chuck was to be a witness in a land fraud case that the state of Arizona was putting together.
So he was kind of like a double agent.
A little bit like a double agent.
Yeah.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Possibly.
Not confirmed.
Not confirmed.
Yeah.
On March 22nd, 1977, Chuck leaves for work that morning. He kisses his wife, takes his daughters to school, but Chuck didn't come home that night. Ruth is really worried, and she realizes that Chuck is probably in danger with some of these unsavory underworld characters he's trying to keep her from.
You think?
Yeah. And it's also during this time that Arizona was really starting to crack down on the crime bosses who were using escrow companies like Chuck's to hide their money or launder their money. Mm. 3 days later, on March 25th, 1977, Chuck stumbles home at 2 a.m. Ruth hears a thump at the back door.
Okay.
Quote, "I was in bed and the dog started barking. I got up, went to the door and opened it, and there was Chuck. He was missing a shoe. He had one plastic handcuff around one ankle and zip ties handcuffing his hands.
Wow.
When he motioned to his throat and didn't say a word, I asked him, 'Can you talk? Can you write?' He shook his head, 'Yes.' So I went and got a tablet and a pen. He wrote that his throat had been painted with a hallucinogenic drug that could drive him insane or destroy his nervous system and kill him.
Wow.
I wanted to call a doctor and the police, but he was adamant that it would be like signing a death warrant for the entire family." End quote.
Jeez.
He also tells Ruth, "I'd been kidnapped. I was tortured."
Hmm.
So she desperately wants to call the authorities. But Chuck is like, "No, honey.
Yeah.
No."
Yeah.
He won't even let her call a doctor. He's super clear. Nobody else can know what happened to him. Because if they let it be known, the whole family would be a target.
Sure.
So for the next week, Ruth dedicates herself to caring for the recovery of her husband. She's feeding him with an eyedropper.
Hmm.
But even before he got his voice back, he started hinting that he had like a secret identity, like he was Clark Kent or David Banner. But Chuck was the secret agent for the federal government.
Okay.
And he wrote down to Ruth, quote, "They took my treasury identification," end quote, and that he'd escaped his captors near the Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport.
Okay.
And according to Ruth, that was the first she'd ever heard of that.
Yeah.
Then he told her he'd been working for them for like 3 years.
Hmm.
And it's true, he did indeed testify in an investigation regarding organized crime, but it's not really known if he was actually a Treasury agent.
Okay.
So Ruth doesn't really know that much about Chuck's business. And honestly, what we know about this case is really mostly from Ruth herself.
Right.
Quote, "Chuck mentioned to me that there was money laundering going on, but nothing that he himself was involved in. He told me, 'The less the girls and you know, the better off you will be,'" mm. end quote.
Okay.
So after his kidnapping, Chuck took no chances.
Right.
He bought a .357 Magnum and wore a bulletproof vest everywhere he went.
That's pretty much taking care of business.
And he made sure he was the only one who drove his daughters to and from school. Because if you know anything about the mafia,
sure.
You don't go after the person. You go after what the person cares about most.
Exactly.
And Chuck even called the school to let him know that only he could pick his daughters up. No one else can pick my girls up from school.
Mm-hmm.
He grows a beard to help hide his identity. He told his father that if anything happened to him, there was a letter that he had handwritten that would explain everything. To this day, this letter has never been found.
Really?
But 2 months after his first disappearance, Chuck vanishes again, June 7th, 1977.
Okay.
He went into work. He left and then called back to the office shortly before noon to say, "I'll be there in 30 minutes. He was supposed to attend a Masonic meeting that night, but he never showed up and he never went back to the office. And that last phone call was the last time anyone ever heard from him.
Really?
A missing persons report was filed and a bulletin was put out by the Pima County Sheriff's Department. Now, Ruth is holding out hope that Chuck's going to show up shoeless and handcuffed one more time in the middle of the night at the back door.
Right.
But 9 days later, on June 16th, Ruth gets a mysterious phone call. An unidentified woman gives her a reference from the Bible. The woman says, "Ruthie," and she says, "Yes." And she says, quote, "Chuck is all right. Ecclesiastes 12, 1 through 8. And then she hangs up.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So what do we know about this Bible verse? Well, Ecclesiastes was penned by King Solomon, according to rabbinic tradition. He refers to himself as the teacher or the preacher in the book. It's really just a reflection of a mortal life, like a biography. And what the woman is referring to in her phone call is what's known as the concluding poem. Quote, "Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come and the years approach when you will say, 'I find no pleasure in them,' before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars grow dark and the clouds return after the rain. Men are afraid of a high place and of terrors on the road. Remember him before the silver cord is severed and the golden bowl is broken, before the pitcher is shattered at the spring and the wheel at the well and the dust returns to the ground it came from and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Meaningless, meaningless," says the teacher. "Everything is meaningless," end quote. Now, I feel like I took y'all to church for a second. But lots of people have suggested that the Bible verse is just foreshadowing that Chuck was going to die, that he was about to return to Jesus.
Yeah.
It's like
dust to dust.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you better give your soul to Jesus because I think his ass belongs to the mafia, right?
Exactly.
On June 18th, 1977, two people are walking on the Papago Indian Reservation and they find a dead body. It's Chuck Morgan.
Wow.
Chuck's body is lying next to his new Mercury Cougar in the desert, 30 feet off Arizona Highway 86, about 40 miles outside of Tucson in the San Juan Springs area. He's wearing his bulletproof vest, and he had died from a single bullet fired at close range into the back of his head. Execution.
Yep.
The gun that was used was his own .357 Magnum. Now, at the crime scene, his gun is lying beside him, but there are no fingerprints on this gun. But gunshot residue is found on Chuck's left hand, which means he was either shooting earlier or he had his hand near where the gun was when it fired.
Right.
Chuck was also wearing a pair of sunglasses, sunglasses that did not belong to him. Mm. When Chuck's body is inspected, authorities find... just wait till you hear this. He had clipped a $2 bill inside his underwear. And Ecclesiastes 12 was written on the bill with arrows pointing to the serial number, and in particular, the numbers 1 and 8.
Really?
Also on the $2 bill were seven Spanish surnames beginning with the letters A through G in alphabetical order.
Okay.
And on the reverse side of the bill, where the signers of the Declaration of Independence are, they're numbered 1 through 7. And a map is drawn showing an area between Tucson and the Mexican border, which lots of people thought was a drug smuggling route.
Okay.
The towns Robles Junction and Sasabe were marked. And these towns were really known for smuggling.
Ah.
So what was Chuck trying to tell the authorities? And what is the significance of Ecclesiastes 12, 1 through 8?
Yeah.
Now, inside Chuck's car, there are oodles of guns and ammo. There were spent shells in his pockets, which might have been why he had gun residue, gunpowder on his hands.
Sure.
His car had a CB radio, and the car had been custom modified so it could be unlocked from the fender. Also in the car was a hand-drawn map to the exact site where Chuck's body is found, with directions written in Chuck's own hand.
Man. Okay.
In the back seat was one of his teeth, which was wrapped in a handkerchief.
Wow.
Also in the car, a briefcase, an empty briefcase. Hmm. It all sounds hinky, right? Sounds like a mob hit, right?
A little bit.
The local sheriff's department rules Chuck's death is a suicide.
Yeah, he shot himself in the back of the head.
Exactly.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, apparently it can be done. It's pretty hard.
Yeah, yeah, whatever.
Medical examiner said that it was unsolved. So let's chat about this for a hot sec. First off, just as you said, how do you put a gun at the back of your head when you're committing suicide?
Right.
Highly unlikely.
Right.
Not to mention, there were no fingerprints on the gun.
Right.
Someone murdered him and wiped the gun clean.
Sure.
I think that's pretty obvious. He wasn't wearing gloves.
Yeah.
Ruth wasn't buying what the sheriff's office was saying either. Quote, there was no way Chuck would have committed suicide, and if he had even contemplated suicide, he would have left a letter for his girls and for me,
yeah,
end quote.
Sure.
So authorities ruled that Chuck committed suicide. They believed he did so either because of financial difficulties or that he was afraid for his safety. And according to Sergeant Joe Jett, the head of the Sheriff's Homicide Unit in Pima County, quote, we have found no evidence that anyone took part in the death but himself, end quote.
You know, if I were a betting man,
yeah,
I would venture to say that maybe the cops are on the take a little bit. I mean, this is the 70s. I mean, you know, there was a lot
it's
of corruption
true.
Going on.
But this is only the beginning of how the rest of this case plays out.
All right, bring it on.
According to the Pima County Sheriff's Department, Chuck was hiding out in an Easy 8 motel for a week before he died.
Wow, a whole week?
Yeah, a whole week. But remember, she said that he was missing. She went
That's
to authorities
right.
okay. and said that he was missing. And they were looking for him.
I'm trying to keep track
they were
of where everybody was.
Looking for him. So who knows if that's true or not.
Okay, all right. Yeah. All right, I'm back.
2 days after Chuck's death, a woman calls the sheriff's department and said, I've got information on Chuck. She calls herself Green Eyes.
Okay.
Green Eyes says, I'm the person who called Ruth after he disappeared to let her know that he was okay. And says Ecclesiastes 12, 1 through 8.
Right.
She tells authorities that she met Chuck in the Easy 8 on the night he disappeared and that he'd shown her a briefcase that was full of money, mostly 20s and 50s, thousands and thousands of dollars in cash that he was hoping would buy his way out of a hit that was placed on his head. She says there's about $80,000 in this briefcase, and she tells police there was a $90,000 contract out on his life that escalated by $5,000 a day.
Wow.
Until somebody got him.
Wow.
Chuck told Green Eyes that it was in retaliation for testimony he'd given before the U.S. judiciary in Washington, D.C. Now, Green Eyes says that Chuck rambled a lot of the time that she was around him. Some of the time he was incoherent and didn't make a whole lot of sense. She said the last time she heard from him was a few days before he was found dead, when he called her around noon and asked her to call his wife and say, I'm okay. Tell her I'm okay.
Okay.
So this woman, Green Eyes, is saying that Chuck knew there was a hit out on his life. He came face to face with his hitman. He offered to pay him off instead of getting whacked.
Right.
But his killer must have taken the money and still murdered him. So for the hitman, it's a win-win.
Sure.
He's getting paid to kill Chuck, and Chuck was paying him as well not to take him out.
He was double dipping.
Double dipping.
Yeah.
3 weeks after Chuck's death, his impounded car is broken into while it's in the possession of the police.
Let me, if I were a betting man, sorry.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
A few days later, two men who said they were with the FBI came to the home of Ruth and Chuck, and they tell Ruth, we need to search your house. And I read in one source that they flashed their badges, but it was so fast that she didn't get a good look. Plus, she's a grieving widow.
Sure.
But these two so-called federal agents, they basically ransacked their home and walked away with nothing, without telling her what they were even looking for in the first place.
Really?
Now, this whole mishigas intrigued a family friend of the Morgans, investigative journalist Dawn Devereaux. Dawn doesn't buy into the suicide theory either. Quote, I've never seen, in all my years as a journalist, a fellow take himself out in the desert wearing a bulletproof vest and shoot himself in the back of the head, end quote.
Yeah.
Don contacts the FBI. He wants to do a follow-up. And what do you suppose the FBI said to him?
This case is closed.
We have no case file on Chuck Morgan.
Oh.
We've never even heard of him.
What?
Yes.
Okay.
Quote, when I made a Freedom of Information Act request to the FBI, they'd never heard of Mr. Morgan, despite the fact they obviously opened an investigation, despite the fact the FBI interviewed Mr. Morgan's attorney. They were all over this thing like a blanket for a while, but now they've never heard of the guy. He never existed. No card, no file, no nothing. End quote.
Wow.
So if Chuck Morgan was doing undercover work for the government, Don Devereaux believes the clues he wrote on the $2 bill might have been an attempt to pass a code to the FBI. Quote, I think the $2 bill provided the basis for some kind of a code. What seemed to be missing, however, was the document that the $2 bill would unlock. If he was quietly providing assistance to the U.S. government and monitoring the activities of one or more major organized crime families, then he wasn't a villain. He was a good guy. And they need to know that,
right.
End quote.
Right, right.
So Chuck's story is featured on Unsolved Mysteries. And Don Devereaux kept digging, and he would investigate any lead that came in. He'll later claim that he discovered evidence that Chuck was involved with money laundering, including Chuck's own records. So was Chuck murdered because he was involved with illegal activity, or was he doing secret work for the government? Because some people believe he was actually involved with his own money in money laundering. He was a part of it,
right,
with the mob.
Sure.
Now, a few months after this case aired on Unsolved Mysteries, a man named Doug Johnston is murdered. And who is Doug Johnston? Well, in 1990, he's a guy who works at a computer graphics company across the street from Don Devereaux. He drove a car that looked like Don Devereaux's. He shot to death in the parking lot across the street from Don's building.
Wow.
And many believe Doug was mistaken for Don.
Yeah.
Doug was right-handed. There was no gunpowder residue on his hands, and the gun was never found. But a medical examiner couldn't determine whether Doug's death was a suicide or a homicide.
Oh, man. When you look under corruption in the dictionary, it was probably this whole crowd.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Doug's death is still unsolved.
How can you? There's no gun. He's dead.
It's the wrong hand.
Yeah, it's just amazing. Okay.
Don Devereaux has had people, journalists, and a CIA informant tell him that, in fact, he was the target when Doug was killed.
Wow.
A year later, Don Devereaux is contacted by an investigative reporter in Washington, D.C. named Danny Casolaro. And he agrees to share all his information on Chuck's case, specifically Chuck's illegal gold transactions. But before these two can meet, Danny is found in a hotel bathtub with both of his wrists slit. Authorities say he's committed suicide.
Yeah.
But Danny had been investigating a clandestine government organization known as the Octopus, and I believe that's what he called it.
Okay.
And Danny was said to be close to breaking a case that may have implicated the mafia, Chuck, and government officials. His case records from his investigation have never been found. And during the inquest, evidence was discovered that suggested he was not alone at the time of his death, including bruises and missing fingernails.
Wow.
All the things that you do before you get into a bathtub and slit your wrists.
Yeah.
The crime scene was also cleaned, destroying potential evidence. A maid gave a statement that there were bloody towels on the floor before, suggesting that somebody came in and tried to clean up. There are those who think he stumbled into information about security software that the government was using to spy on other countries. And on the cusp of taking either of these stories public, or whether these all are tied together, he dies.
Wow.
So we have rogue government agency theories and mob hit theories, or everybody's just committing suicide.
And everybody's pointing to everybody else.
Was Chuck working as a Treasury agent and an informant, or was he laundering money for his mob clients and himself? And who the hell is Green Eyes?
Yeah.
And why hasn't anyone ever done more with this $2 bill with all the names? Yeah. Was it a code? Was he crazy? Ruth said, quote, "They were trying to drive my husband committedly insane. They did not want him to open statewide escrow. He was a very strong man, a devoted and loving husband who did not stray. He was an orderly person. He wouldn't have waited 11 days to shoot himself, but if he had, there would have been a note to me and my children. I've lost a loving husband, a man who will never be replaced," end quote.
Right. Wow.
Ruth died of cancer in 2006. The couple's four daughters maintain that their father was murdered to protect the interests of corrupt businessmen and politicians. Quote, "My father had a lot of information about people here in Tucson that could have been very detrimental. There was a lot of information about politicians, people who are still alive that work in our government. He had that information, and they wanted to silence him," end quote.
Wow.
I think Chuck was involved in money laundering and the underground gold and platinum trade, and that he kept records that would have given the government cause to take down this crime family.
Yeah.
Whether that was Joe Bananas or Ned Warren or the CIA and our own government or the police department, who could say?
Yeah, or all of them.
Or all of the above.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Because they seemed to want everybody who knew anything about this case dead. Although Don Devereaux is still alive. Mm. I believe he is still alive.
Is he in hiding?
I don't know, but he's been nominated for two Pulitzers.
Wow.
So what do you think? Was he part of the mob? Was he an informant for the government? Was he both? Did he just accidentally get in over his head?
Yeah.
Did he know way more than that? Has anybody ever looked into who Green Eyes is?
Right.
And where's that $2 bill? But that's the story of Chuck Morgan, and that's all I have to say about that. Hey, Hitch to Homicide listeners, the wait is over. If you're a reader or a fan of my Sex and Lies series, Book 10, Sex, Lies, and Rock and Roll is now available on Amazon. With a successful tour and 2 years of sobriety under his belt, rock star Noah Hart is ready to put his secrets and the past behind him. That is, until his former bandmates and business partners are murdered one by one, and suddenly he becomes the prime suspect. When FBI agent Louisa Hathaway is assigned to the case, no one, including her partner, is aware she carries her own secrets, including an undeniable infatuation with rock and roll's bad boy, Noah Hart. As the body count rises, Agent Hathaway is torn between unraveling the truth and falling for the man who might be the killer. Don't miss this new book, Sex, Lies, and Rock and Roll, by me, Chris Calvert. Only on Amazon. Rock and roll will never die, but it might kill you.
I like that one. You know, being a...
What would your mob boss name be?
Mine?
Robbie Redhead?
Red Rob.
Red Rob?
Red Rum.
It's got to have something that's more like, you know, it's like Joey Bananas and Maddie this Paulie. So you'd have to be Robbie.
I have no idea. But let me tell you something. Being a composer, I got to do a series on Court TV called Crime Stories.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
So two of the episodes that I remember especially was John Gotti, and then Al Capone was the other one that I scored. And I just loved scoring those two because, like I said, anything to deal with the mafia or the mob, I'm always interested in because it's such a dark world.
Well, I don't know if Gotti had anything to do with all of this stuff going on in Arizona.
Yeah.
But it was around the time that he had just been released from prison.
Mm. Yep. Yeah, there's a documentary out on Netflix right now about John Gotti. It's really interesting. So.
Oh, well, we will put a link to that in our show notes.
All right. Well, enough of the mob.
Enough of the mob.
Let's go on.
And enough of my sexy, sultry voice. Everybody out there wants to give me a cough drop and a hot cup of tea.
But I love that voice. Let's do a little Bless Your Heart. All right. We're going to start off with the first one called, it seems legit.
Okay.
Okay. Two Florida men have been arrested after officials say they pretended to be federal marshals to walk around a resort without wearing masks. This was during the corona.
COVID. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Wear your mask. Yeah. You're supposed to wear your mask.
Walter Wayne Brown, he was 53, and Gary Brummett, 81.
81?
Yeah. Were arrested on February 11th, and I'm not sure what year it was, at the Wyndham Deerfield Beach Resort and charged in federal court with impersonating a federal officer.
Well, why did federal officers not have to wear a mask?
Well, the manager said Brummett went down to the front desk earlier on February 11th for a cup of coffee. After he was asked to put on a face covering, he revealed a laminated card purporting to show that he was exempt from doing so. We'll just put it that way.
I have a letter from my mom.
Exactly. The card was titled Face Mask Exempt Notice Card, according to court documents.
Oh my gosh, this guy.
It was done in crayon. No, I'm kidding. Quote, I am exempt from any ordinance requiring face mask usage in public, the card read. Wearing a face mask poses a mental and or physical risk to me.
Okay.
Under the American with Disabilities Act, ADA, I am not required to disclose my condition to you. The manager said Brummett also pointed toward his belt where a false badge was hanging. Do you know what this means? He allegedly asked.
Oh, gosh.
I'm a U.S. Marshal and can have you arrested if you force me to wear a mask.
I loathe these kind of people.
2 days earlier, employees at the hotel said that they had nearly identical experiences when Brown checked in. When Brown showed up a sans mask on February 9th, they handed him a face mask and asked him to wear it. But like Brummett, he refused and pointed toward his badge and laminated card.
Do you know what this badge is?
It's unclear whether Brown ever put his mask on. But the next day, he returned to the front desk to extend his stay without a mask on. When the manager confronted him, he threatened to have the employee arrested.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. After the interactions, the staff decided to call authorities about the suspicious behavior. When police and an actual U.S. Marshal arrived, they found the two men dining in the hotel restaurant. Yeah.
They're like midway through their complimentary breakfast. They're over there making waffles.
Yeah.
And the U.S. Marshals show up.
Needless to say, they were both apprehended and are awaiting trial.
No,
I know.
Don't try to impersonate.
No, not at all.
U.S. Marshal.
No.
That's bad.
Yeah. Idiots. All right. Number two. Hey, look at me. A bank employee in North Carolina could face decades in prison after FBI investigators say he stole thousands of dollars from a vault and posted photos of the cash on social media.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, according to a release from the United States Attorney's Office, Western District of North Carolina, 29-year-old Orlando Henderson had access to the vault of the bank where he worked in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Okay.
And systematically stole more than $88,000.
And nobody noticed?
I think he was doing a little bit at a time.
Over how many years?
I think 3 days. No, I'm just kidding.
Over 88 years?
Yeah, exactly. He took a buck. He was indicted last week on a litany of charges. According to the indictment, Henderson stole cash from the vault on at least 18 occasions in 2019.
Oh, so he did it on over 18 days, 18 different days.
Right, exactly.
What's 18 into 88?
I don't know.
He
stole the money from deposits made by other customers and used the funds to finance his luxurious lifestyle.
Oh, my gosh. So, like, if people brought cash in.
Yeah.
He would just pocket.
He also put a $20,000 down payment on a new Benz.
I mean, you know, he had his priorities. Yeah. He's out there living the big life.
Yeah. He's also accused of falsifying bank documents in order to obtain a car loan for the remaining balance on the high-end vehicle.
Oh, I thought you were going to say he falsified bank documents to walk out with the cash, dude's working overtime.
Oh, yeah, he had this whole thing planned out. On numerous days on which Henderson stole money, he also made cash deposits at an ATM near his work site, the Justice Department reads. It is further alleged in the indictment that Henderson destroyed certain documents and made or caused others to make false entries in the bank's books and records to cover up the
theft. Okay. Okay. So there it is.
So that's how he did the whole thing.
I mean, it's all computerized. How would you not know?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and during this time that he allegedly robbed the bank, Henderson posted photos of himself holding up stacks of cash on Facebook and Instagram. He just couldn't resist.
He needs the likes.
This is the best part. This is what he said. "I make it look easy, but this is really a process," he said in one Facebook post, which has since been removed. He's got like
90. I make crime look easy.
Yeah, Henderson is charged with 2 counts of financial institution fraud, 19 counts of theft, embezzlement and misapplication, and 12 counts of making false entries.
Yeah.
Yeah. The charges carry a maximum sentence of 30 years in prison and $1 million fine per count.
Wow.
So let me think. That's
he's not going to be on Facebook.
Carry the one.
Anymore.
Carry the one. $30 million. Yeah.
That's scary.
Yeah.
God love it. All right. Bless his heart.
I know. And last but not least, he looks so lifelike.
Oh, no.
Most criminals don't leave an image of themselves behind at the scene of a crime. But police in California say that is exactly what happened when an artist was recently robbed.
Okay.
The sketchy situation began last week in Riverside, California, after a man approached a caricature artist and requested one of the cartoonish renderings. Once the drawing was complete, the suspect quickly grabbed the artist's money bag and fled the scene.
Aww.
Although he was able to make off with approximately $500, the thief left behind his own caricature in the heat of the moment.
Oh my gosh, that's a good one.
The portrait shows the suspect with emphasized features, sporting a thin mustache and wearing an earring. The man has on a backward cap and tufts of hair pushing out from under the brim. In a social media post, the Riverside Police Department described the suspect as a 5'1" black male with an average build in his early 20s.
5'1"? It's Kevin Hart.
I know. This caricature is of a suspect, but of course, the exaggerated characteristics and feature, the police department said. Police are asking the public to help find the man and are hoping that someone in the Riverside area recognizes him from the unique clue.
Is he like running?
Exactly. So there's your three. Bless ya hot.
$500. He must have been a really good guy, a really good artist, caricature artist.
Yeah, I'm sure the picture looked pretty good.
Just like him.
Yeah.
Can you imagine going into the police? This is the guy we're looking for.
And they hired that guy as a sketch artist.
That's good. Yeah. Well, if you have a bless your heart or you know somebody's heart who needs blessing,
yep,
all you have to do is go to hitchtohomicide.com,
yes,
where there's a pull-down menu, and you can also suggest a case.
Yes, you can.
That's all we have today. I apologize for my sultry, squeaky voice. That's my amazing husband out there.
And that's my beautiful bride that pushes all the way through there.
Join us next time on Hitch to Homicide.
Bye, y'all.